That was in really poor taste what I just did there, but we're going to leave it. Hey, everyone. You're listening to a free preview of the Politics Podcast. We're doing something a little different this week. We've invited our friend Julian Sanchez to ride shotgun with us for the full episode. We thought of Julian because he's developed a lot of expertise over the years in issues like privacy law and tech platform regulation that are suddenly quite relevant as Congress contemplates banning or trying to force the sale of TikTok. And so we'll devote the second half of the show to that for subscribers. But Julian's also just a really sharp observer of politics. He brings a libertarian perspective to public affairs, but he's as trenchant a Trump critic as you'll ever hear or read. So we think he's a great match for the politics audience. We hope you enjoy the conversation. And if you like the vibe and want to listen to Julian and Matt fight about TikTok, you can upgrade your subscription to paid at politics.fm. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Politics Podcast. I'm Brian Boitler.
I'm Matthew Iglesias.
And I'm Julian Sanchez.
Oh, you spoil the surprise. So this week we're gonna dive into the debate over whether the federal government should ban or intervene into the ownership structure of TikTok. And we're gonna do that with our friend who just said hello, Julian Sanchez. But as it happens, surprise, Julian's already here, and so we're just gonna chat about the news with him. Say hi again, Julian, and then tell us about yourself, like your journey from Reason Magazine to Cato, and now to like freewheeling Trump critic with stops in between.
Yeah, I spent about a decade as a journalist, first at Reason Magazine and later for the Economist website and the tech news site Ars Technica, where I was the Washington editor. After that, for a little over a decade, I was a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, focusing on national security, technology, civil liberties, privacy, surveillance. I've been taking a little time off and will soon be, I'm also one of the founding editors of the national security blog, Just Security. Probably later this week, I will be joining y'all in the Substack Mines. I'll be launching a newsletter called Non-Content.
I was wondering whether I should tease that you have a Substack and plan to launch it, but now we know it's coming.
It's all out there. That's exclusive. This is what you get listening to this show.
Very exciting.
Important news. So that's cool. You were mentioning, why are you doing this? What's the Substack going to be about? What's going on?
So yeah, it's kind of a triple entendre. Non-content is first sort of just in the sense of discontent. I was a little tired of writing very narrowly about a palette of issues, and wanted a forum to explore a broader set of topics. And also, I think in general, sort of discontent is a kind of prerequisite for writing about politics. But it is also a term of art from the world of surveillance. The non-content information is essentially metadata. It's everything about a communication that is not the human interpretable words of the message. The law generally treats it as less protected and more subject to surveillance, but in part for that reason, because it can be analyzed in bulk, it's often the most revealing part of the communication. And then finally, it's just an expression of my revulsion for the term content as a description for creative or intellectual work. It's a term that sort of takes the perspective of the platforms, where the pipes are what's important, and the content is just whatever goes in the container, the slurry that's sort of fed to you. And I just think that's a kind of toxic way for writers or creators in any medium to think about their own work.
I take a more self-involved view of the term content. I feel like what everyone else makes is content, and what I make is extremely special.
You make journalism, we make content. Yeah. So what happened this week? It's been quite a week, right?
I have a list of stuff, but I kind of want to toss it to Julian to see which ones of these things most interest you. So we had Trump was supposed to be on the hook for almost $500 million of bond to keep his properties and money in New York, and then got a last minute reprieve or amnesty from an appellate court in New York. It seems like Republicans are giving up on impeachment. You have these House Republicans who are retiring because I think they're uncomfortable with running in a party where like the leader is taking money from who knows who. And some of that money came through Trump's like the shell company that's taking Truth Social public and supposedly made Donald Trump like a couple billion dollars richer, like overnight, at least on paper. I mean, these are all kind of one story if you look at them from a certain angle, but like what really got your gourd this week, Julian?
I guess I was a little concerned about the appellate court tossing Trump a lifeline in part just because I was kind of reading the tea leaves a little bit. I wonder at least whether that suggests a disposition on the part of the appeals court to reduce the overall amount levied against Trump. But I mean, I suppose from the perspective of New York State getting its money, at least this is an amount he will probably be able to come up with. And if he's not, that'll be informative as well. We'll see how readily he's able to do that. But at least provides them with sort of a minimum that they'll have secured.
So basically, when Trump was found liable for civil fraud, the judge in the case basically rendered a judgment against him, exactly what the attorney general of the state wanted, something like $375 million, and then another almost $100 million in interest that the state would have accrued if he hadn't been committing all this fraud. And the way these judgments work in New York is that anyone can appeal, but if you want to stall the judgment from being enforced, you have to post a bond of equal or greater value, basically so that you can't appeal, run out the clock, and then be like, there's no money here. Trump was looking really desperate, like he was not going to find the money. And there was speculation and even some, I think, hints that he was going to look for it from foreign oligarchs or autocrats or whoever, or maybe some like really connected Republican connected American billionaires. But then on Monday, without explaining why, the appeals court, who he had asked to like just stall out this process, said, you have 10 more days. You only have to come up with $175 million, and that will be enough to like stop Letitia James, the attorney general, from taking your property. And also we're going to let some of your business associates off the hook from the censures. They were basically prohibited from doing business. We're going to say that's put on hold too. And so because they didn't explain why, now Trump has 10 more days to find the money, and it will be very funny if he can't come up with it, because it'll prove that he's much poorer than even his critics suspect. It's just raising these questions about like when a judge does something favorable for Trump in the federal level, we can look and see like who's the judge, who appointed this judge. And it often tells you a lot about why they might be doing a favor for Donald Trump. But now we're kind of left to wonder, like, is it because the judgment really was excessive, or are they cowed? Are they scared of like MAGA, or are they scared that like enforcing the judgment will help him politically in some way, or are they like enthralled to the New York real estate world? And like, I don't actually know the answer to those questions, but maybe you guys with your, you know, New York-ish origins can provide some insight.
You know, I mean, definitely what occurred to me is the question of whether the New York state legal system is comfortable with the idea of assessing damages of this scale, like in general, right? Like in terms of its impact on the real estate industry. Because, you know, I mean, like what Trump will say about this case is that like he's being unfairly singled out, he's being unfairly persecuted, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, Tish James's point of view is going to be that like that's not true, that she's enforcing the law fairly, et cetera, et cetera. But it is true that like we don't see a lot of cases of this nature being brought by the Attorney General's office. And like if you take her at her word, like this could potentially portend some kind of like larger crackdown on shady real estate valuation practices in New York State, which like doesn't sound like the worst idea in the world, but like obviously would be controversial, right? And I mean, Julian, you were saying this, right? But the interim appeal ruling, right? It seems to portend an appeals court saying that this level of, that the level of damages was excessive.
Well, and it's not just the bond that was reduced. They also paused a lot of Ingoren's restrictions on Trump himself, right? Ingoren had imposed an independent monitor on the company, and that's still in place. But he'd also essentially barred Trump and his kids for a period of several years from running a U.S. A New York based company or obtaining loans from New York banks. The appeals court basically put all of that on hold as well. So, you know, you don't want to read too much into these kind of temporary procedural stays, but yeah, you do wonder whether that's suggestive of what the court might be seeing on the merits. I mean, usually there's not a sort of total disconnection between their evaluation of the likelihood of the appeal succeeding and the sort of aggressiveness with which they intervene to.
What bugs me about it, like, and I don't pose this as something that I think you guys are going to disagree with, but it's like the Trump era, and he sows all kinds of doubt, almost all of it sort of fabricated, about whether people are out to get him and the ulterior motives of the people trying to hold him account. And then on, you know, I think on the more like our side of things, where people are assessing this without like just self-interest at play, we see like Donald Trump getting away with a lot. And I think that judges almost everywhere by this point should know that like the credibility of institutions just like the judiciary is at stake every time they make a decision that touches him in any way, right? And when Letitia James asked for 300 and whatever million dollars, it was based on like a detailed assessment of like what the borrowing was, what the value of the values of the property were stated to be and really were. And so if pressed by a judge like she was to defend her request for damages, she could say, look, it's just mathematics. It's adding up the numbers. And the judge agreed. And then these appellate judges say, nope, but like their decision not to explain themselves, like if, I get it when it's this Supreme Court and they do a favor for Donald Trump and they do it on the shadow docket and they don't explain why. You know, I have a pretty clear sense of why they do that. But why would this court that I admittedly know almost nothing about do something similar that even if they have in their heart of hearts or like when they discussed it amongst themselves, like a reasonable basis for doing it, why wouldn't they just say, like, we have some concerns about the tabulation that the Attorney General and Judge Engoron made. This doesn't mean that we're going to reverse it, but we think that it's reasonable to let the appeal bond stand at a lower level in case there was a mistake.
I mean, that's a good question. You know, but I mean, I think that there has been a general trend, right? I mean, if you think about Jesse Eisinger had this good book that came out, I think in 2014 or 2015, about the decline in sort of white collar crime prosecutions in the United States. And that dates back to after the Enron scandal, when the Bush administration's sort of initial reaction to that was like, they didn't want to put in place like big policy reforms in response to Enron. They wanted to just sort of go hard using the existing statutes at some of the companies involved. And I believe it was Arthur Andersen, the accounting firm, was like found guilty at a trial court, which led to the bankruptcy and dissolution of the company. And then the conviction was overturned on appeal to the Supreme Court later. But you can't like put Humpty Dumpty together again in the same way. It sounds weird to say that like a corporation is in some ways like more harmed by a guilty verdict than a natural person. But it's like, if a guy's in jail, you put him out of jail, or you can stay out of jail pending the appeals process. Whereas like a company, right, like the original ruling in the judge's case would have demolished the Trump Organization. Whether or not the Trump Organization eventually prevailed on appeal. Right.
Well, okay. No,
this is just like created, I think, a generally difficult situation for like the idea of doing sort of white collar prosecutions, which is then intersected with all this Trump stuff. And I think that people don't, I mean, what's frustrating to me as an observer of the scene is that it really looks to me like Trump is given special consideration in the judicial process in light of the fact that he is a major political figure and that everybody wants to bend over backwards, everybody except maybe Tish James, to like indicate that like we're not singling him out. And that means he gets like extra consideration. Whereas Hunter Biden seems to me to be in the opposite situation where, you know, the stuff that he's being charged with, like, this seems like real, like he doesn't seem like a great guy, but these are cases that are being pursued because he's the president's son and because the Justice Department is trying to make a grand show of integrity. And the point of that, like on both sides, is supposed to be to have this like system legitimating function, right? That like Joe Biden is not persecuting his political enemies. Joe Biden's own family is subject to the rule of law. And as a politics, like it completely fails, right? Like nobody understands the situation that way. In particular, nobody who's like in a remotely persuadable political camp is looking at this and is like, wow, like the Justice Department is even going after the president's like one surviving son. And every court in America is like bending over backwards to be generous to Donald Trump. When like, I think clearly that's what's going on. And it's going on for, not for like bad reasons necessarily, but like for reasons that are completely inefficacious.
An optimistic gloss on the appeal bond ruling is just, you know, the function of requiring appeal bond is not to sort of impose a crushing burden on the defendant pending appeal, but to guarantee that the state can recover. And in this case, there isn't really a question, you know, certainly, you know, it's likely that he is a lot less wealthy than he likes to pretend, but there's not really a question of whether ultimately he has assets, not in a particularly liquid form, that could ultimately cover the amount of the fine. So, you know, part of the reasoning might just be, look, this isn't a case where there's a serious risk that, but for this bond, there's no way the state can extract $500 million from Trump or the Trump Organization.
I mean, you know, if they had said that, right, like I think something that like we might all feel much more comfortable with is if they had just said, look, Trump's assets are illiquid, which is why posting the bond is difficult. But precisely because the assets are illiquid, we don't think he can abscond with them. Right. And like the state can just seize the real estate.
Right. And you can't take Trump Tower to Indonesia and.
Right. The golf club. Right. Like these are all sort of physical locations. And but to Brian's point, right, like they didn't say that, or at least they didn't communicate that idea super clearly to the world.
And right. And I mean, this is what but this is why even this still leaves me a little cold, is that like. Judges make decisions about whether to stay a law or let a law go into effect in ways that will have like lasting harm to potential litigants all the time, every day. The idea that, well, like if we don't stay this, it'll cause harm to Donald Trump that might be irreparable if he ultimately prevails on appeal. Is like maybe a critique of how the system works, but it's not a reason to give him special treatment under the system, right? If this court had said, look, like this case is so extraordinary that it's made us realize that we need to reconsider the New York system that requires litigants to put up 110-ish% of the judgments against them if they want their assets to remain unseized while they appeal. And Trump is just the lucky SOB who gets this special favor because he was assessed this judgment and it's super big. And now we have to take that seriously. I'd say, well, like, maybe I don't agree, but at least there's an idea there. It's actually like a kind of a libertarian idea. You know, like, I don't think it's crazy for New York to say, you know what, the way we do this is not super fair, given that the people's appeal rights are like guaranteed to them, that they might risk this kind of harm on appeal. But they haven't done any of that. Like, it seems like if tomorrow some unconnected or much less connected real estate scumbag in New York gets caught doing the same thing and run through the same process and assessed a similar fine, he's going to have to post the whole bond. That's my guess. And like, why not Trump?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I agree with you. It's just, my intuition about this is that there is a lack of actual desire in the higher echelons of New York State politics and government to be throwing the book at real estate companies over playing weird games with the valuation of their assets, right? That, like, on one level, people kind of cottoned on to this idea because Trump, as is often the case, seems like a kind of egregiously sharp player in these kind of areas. But I seriously doubt that he is the only owner of hard-to-value illiquid real estate assets who has made these kind of quasi-victimless misrepresentations. And, you know, on one level, if you could, like, represent to everyone, like, we actually are just persecuting Donald Trump unfairly, that might make the powers that be in New York State feel better about what's happening. But, like, you can't say that, right? Like, that's, you know, illegal. And the prospect of a broad crackdown of this kind, I think, probably gives some people in the state the willies. But I don't really know. You know, I would say, I mean, I don't know. You know, I think everyone interprets all events as kind of vindicating their own positions. But to me, the way these various different cases against Trump all seem to me to be slightly running aground, it confirms my sense that, like, I just feel like there's this ongoing idea that we're in, like, year seven of, that there's, like, some method outside the scope of, like, normal politics through which Trump is going to be defeated, right? Whether it's, like, the Hamilton electors or Bob Mueller or Tish James or, you know, Colorado ballot disqualification or something like that. And I feel like every different tunnel that you go down with this kind of stuff ends up not working. And you can kind of analyze the specifics behind each of these things, but it comes down to the fact that, like, a very large minority of the American public is, like, really likes Donald Trump. Like, that's why he's the Republican Party nominee. That's why Republican members of Congress are either lining up behind Trump or quitting or just being Lisa Murkowski. And it's like, we're going to have to put it to the test, you know, like, on election day. It's like, do people prefer Trump or do they prefer Joe Biden, all things considered? And none of this other stuff is going to work. Like, to the extent that legal processes can reveal embarrassing information about Trump that makes people feel less good about him, that's, like, that's relevant and has, you know, always been a kind of important part of, like, quasi-judicial politics. But I don't know, you know, like, he got this apparently, like, big infusion of money from, like, longtime conservative donors, which seems very corrupt. It feels to me like that should have been like a six alarm media fire, but instead it's just kind of tuned out along with the miasma of everything else. And I don't even know what to do about that at this point. Like I was like, I'm going to write a thing about how like it seems bad for Trump to be just like on the take. And I was like, I don't even know. Like, what am I supposed to say that's like, that's new and fresh about that? So I wrote about the Republican Study Committee because I did have something new to say about that.
I mean, I will say at this point, I think the civil and criminal cases against Trump are now kind of hopelessly entangled with normal politics. It's not like, you know, what is going to do the job? Is it going to be these sort of extra political factors or the voters at the voting booth? Because I think you have a lot of, in particular sort of low information voters who are probably the only ones who don't have a pretty strong view at this point about who they're going to vote for. For whom I suppose it's sort of an open question still, perhaps, whether, you know, well, the Democrats say Trump is a criminal and a fraud and a sexual assailant and mishandles classified information. But, well, is that rhetoric? And, you know, to the extent we get to the next election and no consequences have eventuated for all of these things Democrats say he's done wrong, I think that type of voter may well conclude, okay, well, you know, they say he's done all these things, but nothing seems to happen to the guy. It must just be political rhetoric. We joke a lot about the people who wouldn't care if he shot a guy on Fifth Avenue, but I think there is probably a pool of folks who are inclined to, give short shrift to what they might think is overheated rhetoric, in part because it seems unbelievable that one person really could be this heinous, but would view it differently if, you know, he had a jury verdict or failed at appeals and actually had to pay that fine for fraud. We're not able to argue, well, yeah, I know I lost to the short run, but that was one Democratic judge and surely that's going to get overturned on appeal. So I think, you know, in some sense it matters to the politics, whether the legal system confirms that this is not just rhetoric. He really is liable or guilty for the things that he's been accused of.
Yeah, I think what you said is so important, Julian. And like, you know, Matt, you note, and I think it's true, but only like part of the story, that when institutional actors like judges are at these crossroads, they're like 40% of the country really likes Donald Trump and they don't want any part of like applying normal accountability mechanisms to him or people around him because of that. But like, I want these judges to ask themselves, is it because he is popular or because he is a menace? Because Joe Biden also is well liked by about 40% of the country, or I don't know, maybe it's like 36 this month. That's a lot of people. And like his son is going through it. And yeah, it doesn't seem like anyone in the judicial system is scared about putting Hunter Biden in jail, if that's what it comes to. And I wouldn't particularly care if Hunter Biden ends up in jail.
But that's actually part of what I mean, though. Like, I actually don't think that Biden is popular among like his base in that same kind of way. Like in a healthy way. You know what
no,
I mean?
The people who approve of Biden's
job performance just like Democrats, right?
They're not going to grab their pitchforks and their torches and like maybe murder a judge if a judge decides to put Hunter Biden in prison for breaking the law. And that's what once the judges start thinking in this way, they really are bending to mob justice. And it's like, I think that we're seeing it in very analogous ways across mediating institutions, right? Like this is not actually a hot take. I actually think it's true. It's like the NBC News hired Ronna Romney McDaniel, the recently deposed RNC chair who was with Trump through the coup and until last week. And why did they do that? And like, it's created this immense, strange and seemingly unsustainable backlash among the talent at the network. Did they do it because they are genuinely committed to, representing both sides of the aisle, even if one side goes insurrectionist, or are they preparing for life, the 50-50 chance that this time next year we're going to be back under Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is the sort of person who will try to hurt NBC.
Sure.
If NBC doesn't appease him. And I think that, like, if anybody like a judge or a news exec or whatever else can't convincingly rationalize why they're doing things that seem to be like favor currying with Trump, then they should really ask themselves really hard. Are you letting his kind of corruption seep into your institution willingly?
I agree with you. I think like the idea, an interesting thing about the first Trump administration that I think has given a lot of left of center people undue complacency is that most of the business community treated Trump as a weird kind of passing phenomenon that was not likely to stick around, who they were happy that he was going to like do some tax cuts or, you know, other kinds of things like that, but that like Trump was not the future. I think like we know historically that like rich businessmen often just like love right-wing authoritarian governments, you know, and like I think that's like, if Trump wins again, it is very likely that he will end up having dramatically higher levels of institutional support from like people in authority through a mix of, you know, fear and whatever else, those kind of things. But I was struck, I mean, judicial-wise, by the sexual abuse ruling, you know, which was like, that was the one case that we've seen really sort of go through to fruition, right? Like Trump
and there was
lost.
A jury.
Right. There was a jury. Trump lost, like quite clearly. On its face, it seems like it would be quite damaging to a politician. I watched, you know, it just seems like the quintessential like career-ending scandal. And I feel like
Citizen
it was like,
Kane, you were going to mention Citizen Kane.
It just feels like barely a speed bump to Trump, you know, like people in the conservative informational ecosystem, like genuinely didn't care about this in a way that I find like difficult to relate to. Like, I don't know. Yeah. Like, I don't want to say that like left of center people are immune to like epistemic bubbles and all these other kinds of cognitive problems. But like, I hear liberals complain a lot about Joe Biden. Whenever he does specific things that they don't agree with, they get mad. I don't know, but like it really like came and went. I mean, I was totally open to the hypothesis the day before, you know, that verdict came down, like this would be a big deal that would like really derail Trump in some kind of noticeable way. And it just hasn't. Like I see like Byron York with a straight face getting indignant that liberals say he was found guilty of rape when actually it was sexual abuse. And like, as far as I can tell, he's like totally earnest about that. Like he thinks that the big story here is people inflating their characterization of exactly what that ruling said, not what Trump did or the content or the substance of it. And it makes me want to like, just like give up on life and go home. Like I don't know what else to say about it. You know, like this is not like the kind of journalism that like any of the three of us like really do. But I always had a belief that that kind of stuff like impacted the world.
Well, yeah, I mean, like you were describing the set of like incentives and frustrations that drove me into this like myopic. Why won't Democrats? Because like Democrats don't include the fact that Trump is a rapist in their statements about him. They just don't mention the Carroll verdict. Like Nancy Pelosi was asked about it on cable news once, and she's like, "I don't really know who that woman is." Like, took seemingly no interest in this lingering question: will Trump be adjudicated a rapist or a sex abuser by a jury? And like, maybe my theory can be falsified because someday Democrats will wake up and realize they're running against a rapist and this might be advantageous to them to note, and it won't work. But until they do, like, it's the last thing left. Just just hector them until they start.
Maybe
it is. It is sort of bizarre the reluctance to season, especially since the liability was sexual abuse, but a judge did find that it was not defamatory to characterize what he was found liable for as rape, because New York has a fairly limited definition of rape, such that it requires basically penile penetration, but that in many other states, what the jury found he did would be classified as rape. And so he said, basically, colloquially, it is not defamatory to call what he did rape. Notice to the press, you are legally in the clear to refer to him as rapist and former president Donald Trump.
This is actually happening now. Like, Trump is suing ABC News and George Stephanopoulos because Stephanopoulos used the characterization rape instead of sexual abuse. And Trump is taking a page out of Byron York's book and saying that's defamatory. But it was the judge in the case, Lewis Kaplan, who said, like, basically, Trump forcibly put his fingers in her vagina instead of his penis, and that's why New York law calls it sex abuse. But if it happened to someone in your family, you would call it rape, and that would be totally okay. It wouldn't be defamatory to say that. And so Republicans seem currently to have a free pass to get angry at the press for overstating the verdict, because there's no one on the other side of that controversy being like, you guys nominated a rapist, and that's your cross to bear. Enjoy.
George Stephanopoulos did say it, though. I mean, this is there's a kind of a, I don't know what, angle to this, but I don't think it's true that nobody has said this thing.
No, I'm talking about Democratic campaigners, basically. Surrogates for Joe Biden. Joe Biden himself.
Right. I mean, I'd be curious to know, though, what's the research, whatever, on it. There is a genuine asymmetry at work, right? In which, the conservative ecosystem is, not interested in this kind of thing. The reason why these kind of scandals are normally very, very damaging to politicians, I think, is that it's hard to convince people that their longstanding opinions about abortion or gun rights or taxes are mistaken. Whereas something like this guy's a rapist, doesn't have ideological or policy content. So people who are not that politically engaged, people who have somewhat mixed feelings between the parties, can be very impressed by sort of damaging personal information about someone. And people who are very ideological can say, I agree with this guy about some public policy questions, but also this thing he did that isn't, that happened, right? That's why, when John Edwards turned out to be cheating on his cancer-stricken wife, that just ricocheted around in liberal media because people don't think that's a good thing to do. And it was completely orthogonal to what people liked about John Edwards. And I'm gonna toss this to Julian because you are closer to these circles, but it's I don't understand what's going on in right-wing American politics such that there is no interest in these non-ideological questions about what is the nature of Donald Trump, because it defies how I think electoral politics normally works, and it's put everyone into an incredible state of confusion.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the true believers, the Trump myrmidons just don't believe it's true. A jury found Carol credible and found the friend she told about it contemporaneously credible, or more credible than Trump, as probably most people would. The hardcore obviously just don't buy that it's true. They think it's another hit job. And I think Trump has actually done a sort of weirdly good job of creating the sense that essentially nothing counts until the Supreme Court has weighed in. Even though, this is a court verdict, it's, it could be overturned, but right now the the state considers him to be liable for sexual assault and considers him to have defamed Carol by claiming that she lied about it. But I think he has sort of thrown enough chaff that even among those who are not just convinced that any derogatory claim about him is a liberal fabrication, there may be a broader sense that, well, you know, no verdict is actually final until the Supreme Court says so. As he's done a pretty good job of again dragging out the consequences of any sort of adverse rulings.
I think if people want to know how Republicans avoid cognitive dissonance or just there's like feeling disgusting about themselves when they pretend to believe that the Carroll verdict is meaningless or whatever. They can, like the episode we did with Tim Miller, he talks a bit about how Republicans are essentially trained. Like, you're all in against Democrats. If Democrats attack you, whatever they're saying, like, you have to just adopt the tone of outrage and indignation that persuade people, whoever listens or whoever sees you doing it, that like, this is like, this is a partisan issue. And if you're on our side, stand with us. Whereas like, I think I know what's going on the Democratic side is what you were alluding to is like, what did the data say? Like they have talked themselves into this idea that when their opponent is a rapist, you don't just pounce, you test it with like a focus group first, which I find bizarre. Like, you're a human. You should know that rapists aren't favored people in general. But when you ask the question, the focus group, how does this attack line make you feel? And the attack line is about how the Republican nominee for president is a rapist. Even liberal voters will be like, ick, because it's low. I mean, it's like, it's a dirty situation. The whole thing is gross.
Well, but
then your data tells you don't call him a rapist. And it's like not good math. It's so like bad.
I think you're like misconstruing like how message testing works. Like the way you do a focus group, right, is you decide in advance what you want the focus group to say. And then you like just like bullshit to have it come out, right?
Not
and so there was a lot of stuff from 2016, you know, where Hillary ran ads that were about Trump being an asshole, essentially. You know, like she had her like famous like mirror ad, you know, showing like what like mean, vile shit Trump said. Because they put them out in the spirit of like pounce, right? And the media coverage of Trump in 2016 was incredibly negative, et cetera, et cetera. And when people did, you know, experimental evaluations of those kind of ads, they found that a lot of them backfired, right? That just like something that they raised the salience of immigration, that most people have right-wing opinions about immigration. And they just, you know, it made them want to vote for Trump more. And so that's made Democrats a little bit learier about what kinds of things they really run with, versus just their kind of gut instinct of like, here's what we know. But I mean, what I'm really interested in here, right? Like every week before we do the show, producer Mike complains to us that like we should be talking more about like how Genocide Joe, you know, is no, but he does, right? And it's like the people who I know who are left of center are incredibly like fussy. I think like to excess, right? Where it's like they see a person who has to take positions on dozens and dozens and dozens of issues, and if they disagree about like any of them, they get like really, really mad.
I mean, I don't know if I would characterize disagreeing on this particular issue fussy, right? I mean, it's not like oh, the
get
the,
Matt
the
canceled, Julian, get
be
Matt
1%
canceled
higher, right?
I'm saying, you know,
it's
Mike,
a fairly significant human rights issue that
this,
you know,
this is
I don't think you're being sanctimonious or puritanical if you think this is pretty important and the fact that our standard bearer is, you know, supporting something I think is a humanitarian right. abomination.
But this is to
not a small point.
That's to my point, though. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's a people who are very fired up about their stuff and are like very interested in having these kind of internal controversies and like who's right and who's wrong. Whereas it's not that like, because I don't want to overly caricature. You know what I mean? Like, you can certainly get conservatives going about various different things and kind of internal, you know, disputes to the movement and policy priorities and, you know, free trade versus America First and stuff like that. But the mass audience, I feel like, really just like wants to hear about how the libs are bad. Whereas when you try to feed libs that stuff, right, like Trump is worse, like people get mad at you. Like they really like rebel against that. They're like, you can't be like shaming me like this. And I don't know. It's just like an interesting
asymmetry
division in American society about how these things work. We're like to offer these kind of takes, I think, really like it alienates a lot of progressive minded people, you know, to say like, unless you frame it as we're going to talk all the time about how Trump is a rapist. And that means we can take left wing stances on every issue simultaneously. If you do it as like our message to the world is like Trump is a rapist and that's bad. And that's why you have to vote for Joe Biden. You know, people don't like it as much. I don't know. I mean, we should probably talk about TikTok at some point.
Yeah, let's put up the paywall here, and then if people want to listen to whether Genocide Joe should ban TikTok to prevent people from getting the real truth about Gaza, you can go to politics.fm and upgrade your subscription.